You may have noticed we have a wacky sidekick again today. Here, on the Twang Trust. Yes. That's what this show is here. The Twang Trust, yes. And boy, if there was an episode of this here show that needed to be like 4 hours long, this one is it. Wouldn't you agree, Brittany? Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We have for you tonight on the Twang Trust, of course, both kinds of music. Patcher and Maze. Yes, live in studio here, guests. We've got a local hero returned. Can you believe it, Brittany? Jeff Hatcher is back in town. And we got him here, standing by to yak at us. And we'll play a few songs and see what he's up to. In fact, he's up to a gig tomorrow at noon. Are you going to go to the gig tomorrow, Britt? Tomorrow at noon? Can you make it? I hope so. Also, stopping by in hour number two, Rami Maze with her record producer in tow, a guy you might know if you've ever heard at least two episodes of The Twang Trust, a fellow we like to call Gerf Dan Blocker Morlix. That's all coming up tonight on The Twang Trust. Are you excited, Brittany? He's been gone 25 years, and he's back. Winnipeg's favorite new wave son has returned. Welcome home, Jeffrey Hatcher.
Hello, Stuart.
Whenever I bump into anybody for the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, and somebody who'd been in touch with you recently, they're always saying, oh, yeah, Jeff and Lee are moving back to Winnipeg. And but you hear it for, you know, 15 years, and you start to doubt its authenticity, you know? were you waiting for real estate prices to skyrocket? Is that it?
What got in the way was school. You see, we'd been planning to come back since about a year or so after the Blue Shadows finished, like about 97 or 98 or so. And then I got into the music therapy, the Bachelor of Music Therapy program in Vancouver, in North Vancouver. And then when that was finished, I soon after that, I got into a graduate program at Simon Fraser University in counseling psychology. So we just kept putting it off another year. And then finally I was finished 2 years ago. And then it took us another year really to extricate ourselves from Vancouver.
Yeah. Well, I thought maybe it might have been too. You were trying to outlive dorks like me who are inevitably will be asking you, when are you getting the band back together?
No, I'd always planned to come back. Well, not always, but for many years we planned to come back. Even when we lived in Toronto, which was before Vancouver, back then we kind of toyed with coming back here sometime. Leah partly grew up here, although her roots don't go as far back as me. I was born here. I'm from classic Winnipeg immigrant stock. My parents are born here, and none of their parents are born here.
Ooh.
So it's kind of I'm one of the kids of the classic immigration waves of the First World War era.
Yeah, all good-hearted folk are, I think. So now it's unfathomable to me, but there may be somebody out there who is not well versed in all things Hatcher.
Well, no thanks to Stu.
Yeah.
I mean, thanks to Stu. It's not for lack of trying. I guess that you've been educating the public.
Every week.
Yeah. About what I've been playing and why over the years. The first band that ever recorded or played live to any degree was The Fuse. We had several versions of that same band for like 2 years before that, going back to when we were like 17 years old, and those bands would play one gig, two gigs, and then we'd go back and rehearse again for 3 months.
Your bass player would blow up, and you'd have to find a new one.
Yeah, Stu is very familiar with the exploding bass player syndrome. A lot of bands have trouble with the drummer or the something. With us, it was we had many bass players over the years. Till finally, I was the last bass player the Big Beat had, and I used to joke, "Oh man, it's so hard to get the right bass player and somebody who wants to stay. One day, I'm just going to play the I'll be the damn bass player already, and that'll be the end of the band."
And I was
the last bass player in the Big Beat. Yeah.
Of course, after the Fuse, the Big Beat was probably the biggest, at least family-oriented stab at success.
Yeah,
until the Blue Shadows came along, which was a pretty exciting thing.
The Blue Shadows, it was pretty exciting for all of us too. There was a brief interim band, The Six, which of course I know you know about The Six, that lasted for about 18 months or so, and that was The Fuse. Really, it was The Fuse regrouped in Toronto with a new repertoire.
Is that all? Is that how long The Fuse or The Six lasted? It seems like it was.
It was about 1982 to 84 when Dave Dave Briggs left and went to school. And then there was no band for a year because Paul left Toronto, came back to Winnipeg, and Don was still in Winnipeg. So I was there alone in town, and I didn't want to get a band together at that time. I just wanted to learn how to write songs better. So that's what I did for a year. But eventually, all those stabs at throwing together the magic band ended with the Blue Shadows, and which lasted, I think it was about 3.5 or 4 years probably, of really going at it hard. Meaning writing, recording, rehearsing, touring, and performing, and all that, doing everything, all the time,
yeah.
With no time off. We worked in incredibly long hours sometimes, that band. Like when we went on tour, we played the way I imagined the bands used to play in the 50s and 60s. You know, you'd play a radio show in the morning, some teen dance at lunchtime, and then you'd play do some radio interview again, and do something else, and then play at night. And if you had time in between that, you'd learn some new material. And that's what we did. When we were on tour, we were always doing that. We did 5,000 interviews, I swear. And we were on every TV show you can find. We played almost every place you can play coast to coast, except Newfoundland, and we played in the States, and we worked hard for old guys.
Yeah, well, it's funny, the Blue Shadows, the very first time I seen them, it was unlike any other time I saw you guys. The first time I saw you was in Vancouver, I think it was, must have been 92, and it was pretty much an oldies show.
It wasn't the Blue Shadows yet.
But,
yeah, what you saw was the Dead Guys set.
Ah.
See, what you saw was the band that I joined about 9 months before as the new guitar player. They lost their last guitarist, Danny Cassavant. Danny had just left the band. Winnipegger,
yeah.
Guitarist deluxe Danny Cassavant. And Danny and I have had this conversation, I have had this conversation with Laurie McKenzie as well. There are guitarists, that's Laurie and Danny, and there's guitar players, that's me. I said, it's okay, guys, I'm not putting myself down. I'm happy to be a guitar player. I have my own moves on the guitar, such as they are, and I'm happy enough with what I can do, but you guys are guitarists. Lucky for me, I can sing a harmony and write a song once in a while. But I had just gotten the guitar player job that guitarist Danny Cassavant had vacated. I got to Vancouver I got a gig opening solo for Roseanne Cash at the Commodore.
Ooh.
And I got that through her management company, who I knew in New York, because we were still newly from Toronto, and I was looking for management for the band in New York, and they were one of the people that I was looking at, Steve Botwin, who was Steve Earle's manager at the time, mm-hmm. as well. And so they vouched for me and said, yeah, this guy is okay. You can use him. This is for the club owner. The Commodore club owner manager, ex-Winnipegger. I lost his name. I'm sorry. Drew, I believe. I never did meet him, but he's legend in Vancouver. Another ex-Winnipeg lad. Anyway, so I needed Danny Cassavant. He's the only musician I knew in town there. I needed his okay at a local music store so that I could rent a 12-string acoustic guitar, which I didn't own one, and I needed that for the show. So he vouched for me, and in talking with him on the telephone, he told me he was just about to leave Billy's band. I'd heard about Billy's band from ex-Winnipegger John Mackey, and of course I knew about the Castles from being a kid listening to the radio. And so I called Larry Wanigas, who was managing Billy and later managed the Blue Shadows. Larry, I'd met when the Fuse was traveling, because he was booking bands at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. So all these spokes of the wheel came together at that time. And Larry got me on audition with the guys, and I went to the Fairview Tavern on Broadway in Vancouver and sang a few tunes and got the job. A few days later, Billy called me, and he told me later that he'd saved my number in his phone book under O for other singers. And so he called me, gave me the gig, and for the next year or so, I was the guitar player in the Dead Guys set. That's what they call it. Once in a while, they play somebody by someone living, but for the most part, Roy Orbison, Hank Williams, the Beatles songs, if John Lennon sang them.
Yeah.
For the most part, it was John Lennon's material, and I mean they were lovable cynics, you know. And so I played with them, Elmore and Billy and Jay on drums, so the band that you saw. What was that? Was that band? It was a very easy band to play in, because for so many years I'd written material and rehearsed the band and been the band leader for a number of years and just done all the interviews and really been kind of really working hard at it, you know. And then this band already had a lead singer, it already had a front man, and I didn't have to rehearse anything because I knew all those songs. Even if I'd never played them with another band, I mean, I knew "Hey, Good Lookin'." I mean, I knew all those '50s tunes and '60s tunes, because I just played them at home by myself, just as I was trying to figure out how songs were written and how the guitar player did their thing and how to fake some pedal steel guitar licks on the electric guitar. So that's the band you saw. You saw the Dead Guys set. A few months after that, we started writing songs together, and we had to change the name and call it something else because we were about to make a record.
Huh. Well, it's funny. The first time I ran into someone who said, oh, Jeff's got a new thing coming out, he's got a CD coming out, it's this band, the Blue Shadows, with Billy Cowsill. And not the Cowsills, I mean, all the average guy knows is hair, and it's like, well, what's that all about?
Yeah,
I couldn't
know.
Imagine, but what? Then you've seen you live, I mean, Billy was amazing, I mean, he was so into what he was doing.
Well, darling Bill, I'm sure wouldn't mind me saying that the Cowsills drove him crazy too, because he wanted to be a rock and roller, and he and three of his brothers had a rock and roll band as teenagers, and when they were discovered, because of a recording they had done. Oh, no, I think because of a live appearance that got them noticed by someone who put them on the Today Show, and then they got into a recording studio and did something wonderful soon after that. But the image was out of the band's control, really. Their dad managed the group and the record company, which was, I guess, was a little more powerful in those days than they are. Mm. Maybe they are now. I wouldn't swear to that because I'm totally out of the game. But they fashioned the band as a bubblegum family act, and that drove Billy crazy to the end of his days. In interviews on the road, he was very nice and respectful and the whole thing, but about the cow sales. But he would get past the subject as quickly as he could, and once in a while he would in private he would, you know, ask him, like, "You say that stuff, Bill. I know it drives you crazy, but you say the nicest things about the cow sales recording crew. But I know it drives you nuts. Like, what would you really say if you could?" This is me as my future counselor career. If you could, if someone was listening, you know, what would you say? And he'd say, and he was really adamant about it. He said, "I'd say the band was stolen from us. The music was pap. They never tapped our true potential. And it totally messed me up when the band finished, because now I was finished with something that I depended on but didn't like." So. It was a big thing, yeah. But the real essence of Billy was not the Cowsills, as I'm alluding to. Like, the thing about him was he was Mr. Americana post-war showbiz. He really was. He was from another time, Billy. Only 10 years older than me, but really he was like Al Jolson.
Yeah.
He was on stage. You saw him on stage. Like, yeah. Man, he lived to show off his stuff for the audience. I can't say that I did. I really poured everything I had into the creation of the material. And as for performing live, I wasn't about to go home without giving it all. But giving it all didn't mean hurting myself.
Right.
And what was your impression of the band that you saw? The Dead Guys set.
It was great. It was a ton of fun, but it was an oldies act. I mean, you can only do so much with a bunch of old songs, which is I always thought was a funny thing with Billy, because he'd been doing that for so long. And then all of a sudden he goes and makes these Blue Shadows records and these songs. I mean, the ones, even, you know, if you take You out of the quotient, they were, what he had were great songs. Like, why wasn't he doing that for the past 20 years?
Well, if he was here, I think he wouldn't mind me saying that, because we talked about this stuff all the time. You know, he and I talked about these kind of things, and the rest of the band as well. And he didn't really have a lot of, because he'd been, as he called it, as he described himself, he'd been like a Clydesdale pulling the plow for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Like, really, since the Cowsills disbanded, any playing he did were those old tunes. He did it to make a living. And he really poured it on when he was on stage, but he did it to make a living. And by the time he landed in Vancouver, that's what he did. It was like one of the highest paid acts playing the circuit around town and outside of town as well. And so it was a good living, and it was easy enough work, you know. A lot of the places we played from, you know, 8 o'clock to midnight. So it wasn't like 2, 3, 4 in the morning, which is easier to do. And I think his confidence was kind of low as far as promoting his own material. He didn't write a lot. He was one of the people, I've met a few people like that too. They're inspired once in a while, and when they are, they write a song in like 8 minutes, and that's they're kind of finished. And people like me who were more into writing songs, or more into writing songs, writing a lot, always had 3 or 4 on the go, and were really keen to finish one off and play it with the other guys and edit it into something usable. But there's always a notebook full of unfinished stuff that you're trying to get back to, and I think, you know, being kicked around of the music business for a few years there too, and a number of other personal things too. I think Billy's confidence was, as I say, just is kind of low as far as his own material went. But when he brought out a couple of his songs, when I asked him, this is with the Billy Cowsill Dead Guys set still going, I said you must write some tunes, like, play me a couple. So he played me The Embers, for example, which, you know, didn't have a bridge, it's just a verse and a chorus, and I wrote a bridge for it, with his permission. I said, why don't we throw something else in there? This is your song. It's been there for years, sitting there. I think it needs a little something in the middle. I'll throw this in, you know? And he was really tickled with what it turned into after that. So I said, well, you know, bring out some more stuff. And I showed him some of my songs. And then I said, well, you know, I know there's a great Billy Cowsill album out there waiting to... waiting to be done. And that, and when I said that to him, that's what preceded me asking him, play me some of your songs, you know, because I thought maybe I could talk Larry into letting me produce an album for him, and I could, you know, I'd be in charge of the repertoire, because guys like Billy, those master singers, there's many, I say guys like that, because there's a lot of people like that, a great voice, and they love to sing, and they will sing almost anything, and they can sing almost anything. And they don't really care that much about editing the repertoire, and I cared a lot about that. You know, the brothers and me and Dave Briggs, we used to write a ton of material and use 1 out of 8 songs sometimes. You know, we've had lots and lots of material, and we just choose the stuff that was best. So I said to Bill, I think that's what we ought to do. You know, let's get a bunch of songs. I'll write some songs for you or with you, and I'll go looking for tunes and bring out some of your old stuff, and we'll knock it into shape, and let's do a Billy Cowsill album. And then when we here's what happened. We started writing songs together, and they became duos. Billy loved singing harmony. We both loved the Everly Brothers, because really Simon and Garfunkel, McCartney and Lennon, really they're kind of sons of the Everly Brothers, and the Everlys are doing that lonesome mountain country harmony from way back, and we loved that sound too, and so we started. Incorporate. I mean, it just naturally came out that and my voice was below his, lower than his, and the harmony just happened. So it became harder to think of it as the Billy, you know, the Billy Cowsill show, the live guys. You know, we had to give the band a name and assume that it had kind of two front guys, with him a little more to the front. You know, and I was happy with that. He was the man with the golden voice. He sang more of the solos. I only had 1 or 2 solo songs. The rest of the solos we threw at him, and then the rest of the, but the majority of the songs were duets.
Well, let's play some from that first record now. What do you suggest? What's your favorite moment on there?
You know what? Since the album was released, I haven't listened to it at all. But then, after Billy died, I've listened to it a lot. I've listened a lot to our recordings a lot lately, and of all these tunes, I think I'd choose for the Embers.
Yeah.
You know, why don't we start with that? You know, because that was the first tune that we not wrote together, because he'd written it. I think he wrote the Embers in the 70s or something. Then,
wow,
almost 20 years later, I brought this bridge, the middle section, to it, and he and I both thought, now this is beautiful. Like, we love this now. This song seems finished now, and he thought so too.
Well, here it is, Jeff Hatcher, Billy Cowsill, and the Blue Shadows.
The embers keep burning long after the fire. Old memories return, like your voice on the wire. Oh, our love's in ashes, you're still my one desire. And the embers keep burning long after the fire. Kind words were spoken, but we said them in haste. Now two hearts are broken, true love is nothing to waste. But my memories are ashes. There's this haunting desire, 'cause the embers keep burning long after the fire. Oh, and burn they will, right on until
Welcome, folks. Here's a brand new song.
At the multi-purpose room at the University of Winnipeg, or Manitoba, rather. We're at the University of Winnipeg. That was Jeffrey Hatcher and the Big Beat.
How nostalgic.
January 24th, 1987. A little number called Rocks and Chains.
I haven't heard that since that recording. You know, I don't have any recordings of that song, and I haven't heard it.
Do you remember that show? I remember that show only because some guys just about pulled the lighting rig down.
Actually, I think they did pull it down.
They did. Yeah.
Yes, it was attached to the PA stack, and it came flying down onto the dance floor.
People could have been killed easily.
Oh my God! Yeah. Really? Yeah. But the dancing is just...
Yeah, it didn't faze anybody, really.
It bumped somebody on the shoulder, and somebody else watched it almost hit their foot, and then nothing happened. I was at U of M last week to do Jeff Robson's show. What was it? What's the name of that show again?
Oh, well, let's see. On Thursdays, it's Steel Belted Radio.
It was Steel Belted Radio. Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah. And I walked past the multipurpose room, which I have not seen probably since that show, you know? It reminded me of all the shows I'd seen there when I was... Before I was a musician, a professional musician, and some of the shows that we did there too, very fun that was.
Yeah. What now was Gord in the band on this one? I couldn't tell. Was there keyboards on that?
Yeah.
Track?
Yeah. Yeah. Gord Gervin was there.
What's he doing these days? Do you keep up with these guys?
I haven't seen Gord since I was in Toronto. I was in Toronto several years ago and ran into him in a club. Yeah, and he was doing well, and he was still playing. Yeah, Gord is a school teacher now. As is. Mr. Briggs, and but he was also playing too, yeah. And I found a photo of him soon after that, a kind of a photo booth photo, and I stuck that on the front of my my phone book, just to remind me of him.
Yes, good times. Before that, the Blue Shadows from their very first album, On the Floor of Heaven, and a very early Hatcher Cowshill composition. Now, of course, Billy passed away not too long ago.
Yeah, Billy died in, I think, February. And I think his birthday was in January. He had just turned...
It was, because I actually did a little birthday tribute show to him on
really?
The radio show here. And then like a week or so later...
You didn't know he was ailing or
well, I knew he was in poor health. I knew he had, like, one lung and that whole bit.
But, yeah, yeah.
But it was still a bit of a... Well, it wasn't a huge shock, I mean, if you knew anything, I guess, but...
It wasn't a big shock to me. No, I talked to Billy about 10 days or a week or so before he died, yeah, and he sounded very rough. I didn't think I would be talking to him again, actually.
And that was the first time you talked to him in a while, wasn't it?
That was the first time I talked to him since the last time we played, which was March 96.
Wow.
So it was almost 10 years. And we weren't angry with each other, but he wasn't one to call you up. For a hey, how you doing? And I became that way with him, partly because I would say, let's see how best to put this. I felt it would make him uncomfortable to hear from me. I knew he liked me. I mean, we loved each other. You know, we drove each other crazy, but got along really well too. And I think we understood each other pretty well too, Billy and I. And I think he wouldn't mind me saying that he didn't feel good about the breakup of the band, about his own role in the breakup of the band. I think it was a source of not good feeling about himself, for himself. And I think everybody knows how that can a few months stretches into a year, and it stretches into a few years, and it becomes kind of that's the way it is. We don't talk now, you know. Yeah. And before his brother Barry died in the Katrina hurricane aftermath, or during the hurricane, we don't know actually how he died. I was thinking of calling him because I'd heard his health wasn't really good, you know, and I also knew that he had, you know, this operation, that operation, a collapsed lung that couldn't be reinflated. So he was living with one lung for many months, still smoking, I'm sure,
yeah,
because he was a pretty dedicated smoker. And I knew he had other back problems and all kinds of stuff going on. You were walking with a cane. And so I was toying for a few months of giving him a call to see how he's doing. And in fact, in December last year, a couple months before he died, I called Jay Johnson, my good friend, who I do stay in touch with, who was a drummer in the band, as J.B. Johnson. And I called Jay and asked him, why don't we think about doing a benefit for Billy? And we'll do a show in his honor, and we'll just get the old band together. We'll get Wendy Bird, beautiful singer and a beautiful friend of mine in Vancouver, sing Billy's parts. We'll do a Billy show, and we'll make some money and send it to him. And when I heard Billy was really in rough shape, it was during this period where we were trying to get this show together. And it was in process of being put together, actually, when he died. It was going to be, you know, just a money raiser for him. a fundraising night for him, and it turned into a memorial for him, of course. But at the time he phoned me, it was because I'd called him after his brother Barry died. I phoned him a couple of times and couldn't get through, so I wrote him a letter, and he called me about a week after that, and we talked about a number of things. And I also mentioned that Jay and I were putting together a little fundraising show party for him, and he said, "That'd be wonderful." And then he died about a week later, so we had to change the nature of that. But yeah, we hadn't talked for years, Billy and I. I knew how he was doing because I knew the people he was playing with in Calgary, and people in Vancouver that we both knew. You know, if they came back from Calgary, I'd run into them somewhere. They'd tell me how he's doing, or he's just out of the hospital, or he's playing with so and so, or they just made a recording. And so I knew what he was doing and roughly how he was doing. But you know, but the more intimate day to day stuff, no, we didn't have that.
Well, I think we're actually going to listen to something now. One of the last things Billy, in fact, the last thing he ever recorded, I guess. It's recently released on a 2-CD set called Sorrow Bound, Hank Williams Reexamined. What it is, it's a bunch of Alberta folks who, there's one disc of Hank Williams covers and then a disc of what they call songs inspired by Hank. And this is one of those. He's, did you know him as a big Hank freak?
Oh God, yeah. Billy, he told me years ago that he had wanted to audition back in the 80s for the Hank Williams the Show He Never Gave.
Oh, he'd been amazing in that.
Oh, yes. he would have been killer at that.
Yeah.
And he said, it didn't happen. But he said, oh man, if only I'd got a chance to wear that suit.
Oh, that would have been incredible to see that.
That's all I wanted to do was wear that suit. And Billy, there would have been no one more perfect.
Yeah.
For Hank. I mean, he could do Hank Williams' voice to perfection. And he was a tall, skinny guy. And he was an actor, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, I've seen pictures on somebody's websuit of Billy playing in some old Western TV show thing. I've never seen the show. I don't know what it was.
I haven't either. I think it was Lonesome Dove.
That's right.
And I never saw it, but somewhere during the Blue Shadows touring, we stopped off somewhere in Alberta and took a day off, and Billy did a day of filming.
Wow. So they never asked you in on that?
No. Yeah. I've never been asked to act. No.
Well, here we're going to hear Billy Castle, the last thing he ever recorded, and then we'll come back and talk with Jeff Hatcher again about, in fact, why he's here tonight. He's going to be telling us about his first official playing gig since his return to Winnipeg. Very exciting. But here's Billy and a song called It's Over Now.
This can't go on the way it's been. There's just no way on earth the two of us could win. It would come now like some surprise. I should have seen. Start.
greatest test of time. It's all.
Cowsill on the Twang Trust here on CKW 95.9. Scarily prophetic there, huh? As the last song?
Really? I hear Billy getting the last word in too. He sings on the vocal track.
Mm-hmm.
He loved that stuff.
Yeah.
He loved doing last oohs or ums in the fade outs.
You could just tell he was such a fan of music, you know? Just in the purest way.
Yeah.
I mean, as much, you know, garbage as he went through as far as industry stuff goes, you could tell he was just just pure at heart in his love of music.
Oh, yeah. And we used to talk about, we had a lot of things in common, you know, that we had done when we were younger, like singing harmony in church when we're singing whatever hymn is mm-hmm. happening, singing harmony, trying to find the bass harmony, trying to find the alto harmony or the... just for fun, because your ear is guiding you that way. And he said, I used to do that too. And we tried a couple of things out on each other. And just things like that. And we both had pet peeves too, like when someone had covered the song Help. Help me, ooh. And they finished with ooh instead of oom, which is what really happens. Didn't that piss you off? That always pissed me off. Yeah, that always bugged me. But we had 100 things like that. Remember when so-and-so did so-and-so? Yeah, and he left out the so-and-so? Oh, that drives me crazy.
Yeah, he was... it's funny, because he was such a great songwriter, I always thought it was kind of odd that he stuck so close to the arrangements of old songs. Like, he never tried to fiddle with them at all. He sort of went out of his way to recreate it as perfectly as possible.
I know, that was his task, really. That's the task he set for himself. Mm-hmm. Really learning the stuff that was like the bedrock of where he came from, and really do it right. That was his approach. Mine was to, you know, do whatever you want, really, you know, and do whatever you want, and then see which of it fits into the live band or this next recording. See what kind of hangs together, you know, as parts of a whole. And I think it was a good combination in the end, really, because Billy was so strict about you know, his industry standards. Which was not my way of doing it, but it really added something to what I did, and my own approach added something to gave him some. I think it helped give him a little bit of freedom to try new things in the studio. And in the end, the Blue Shadows, they were it was, you know, it was a fun like it was like the summer, you have the summer off kind of band, you know, to do the songs or the types of songs that the record company wouldn't let you do, or that your parents wouldn't let you do, you know, or that somebody wasn't letting you do, but you had the time off and you could do whatever you wanted. So we just did this fun thing. And there's all the elements of Buddy Holly, the early Beatles, and Roy Orbison and George Jones. And we were totally fine with it. You know, we just throw it all in there and see what comes out. So, and for me, it wasn't my big artistic statement. It wasn't that this is who I am, you know, as if I was important, you know. Yeah, it was a fun, a soulfully fun enterprise.
Now there's rumors of older Blue Shadows stuff, hitherto unreleased, seeing the light of day.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that we recorded fairly frequently on the road, because we always had new material, and we thought we should just get it on tape, you know, for posterity, and a lot of covers as well. You know, we loved Arthur Alexander tunes and George Jones. We just record stuff, and if we wanted to record something, like for this Christmas release, we did Merle Haggard's "If We Make It Through December,"
yeah.
And then we rewrote the lyrics for "Run, Run Rudolph,"
yeah.
Or "Run Rudolph, Run," and for a Christmas thing. And while we did that, we did something else as well. We just record a couple other tunes. So now that Billy's gone and there's a demand for his material, our management is got in the works some kind of schedule for re-releasing material. And I think I haven't heard the latest word. I mean, I haven't heard the last word. The latest word is that they'd like to do the first album with some extra songs on it that were never released, which I think is what I would prefer. As a start, anyway, there's a lot of material out there that we did that we're quite proud of, and Billy would be glad to see it out as well. And for the people that really loved the band, and I run into them all the time, people they loved that sound or they saw the band live, then I'd like them to have it. I don't care if it's not a money thing at all. I don't care if it brings me any money.
Yeah, the Blue Shadows happened like just a little too soon, I think, in the grand scheme of things, because at the time nobody had ever heard the phrase alt country before.
And no, that's
five
true.
5 years later, you know, all this thing's happening, you know, No Depression magazine, the whole bit. And, you know, I think if you're around now, it would be huge.
It could be, yeah. I was saying to Jeff Robson at U of M that, you know, the idea of being before your time or ahead of your time, it's in hindsight, it seems true. And at the same time, it seems to me that things happen, like the time produces you, too. You know, the time and the place produces you. So Vancouver in 1991 or two, whatever, we were there making music in this area, in this era, in this place, and we both had this common history of some sort and uncommon history as well. And those elements at that time produced what happened. And so in the end, it seems like it would have been quite a smash a few years later. I know that when we played in Seattle, the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, that... when we listened to the other bands, other local or other elsewhere in America bands that were playing at the time too, our approach was different, and I can see now that it was heading toward what became alternative country. Yeah,
yeah.
And it was of its, it could have been, yeah, ahead of its, seen as ahead of its time. Now it was of its time, certainly.
Yeah, well, now after the
as everything is,
yes. Well, after the Blue Shadows sort of disintegrated there towards the end, you stuck it out in Vancouver and with the rest of the guys, sans Billy.
Yeah.
What happened there?
Well, in the last like two or three years of the Blue Shadows, I'd been singing just casually with a friend of mine, Wendy Bird, who has a beautiful singing voice. And we played, I mean, the Blue Shadows are pretty busy, but when we weren't busy, those brief times when we had a week off or so, she and I would play, you know, at my place, her place, or some coffee house, or some pub somewhere. And when the Blue Shadows finished, I called the clubs that we'd normally played back in the dead guys, back in the old circuit, and I told them I could put a band together. I had a great singing partner here that and a different repertoire, and we did. We had 70 or 80 songs or so that weren't Blue Shadows repertoire songs, and so I booked the band, and it was logical to ask Barry and Jay to step in and be the rhythm section, and Wendy played acoustic guitar. So there we were. It was like a ready-made band, and I had a feeling that I wouldn't put another band together after this one. I wanted to do something different. I still wanted to do something musical with my musical history and training and all that, but I didn't want to get a band together and tour and record and all that stuff in the classic way. So this was a good treading water kind of period for me. Mm-hmm. That year, which was 1990, the rest of 96, actually. No, was it? I guess it was 96, 97. Anyway, at the beginning of 97, I went to school. And the Blue Shadows songwriting royalties put me through school. Mm. Bless their heart. And during that first year of my being back in school, the music therapy program, I continued to play with them, with those guys. And after that, I was too busy in school. I was just between working as a music therapist and being in school. And soon after that, I was I was working full-time, almost full-time, and in the graduate program at Simon Fraser University. So there was no time left in the calendar to play anymore. So I folded it up.
That whole music therapy thing, that's what you're doing now, back home here, huh?
I am, yeah. I'm a professional music therapist, clinical worker. I've been doing that for about 6 years now.
The whole music therapist thing is a bit nebulous, I guess. It's sort of a case-by-case scenario to some degree, what you're actually doing.
excuse me. Yeah, the easiest way to describe what you do is to describe what you do with a certain kind of client, mm-hmm. really, because there isn't one thing you do physically. Like, there's nothing you can describe to people that would tell them. Yeah, you can't really say what you would do in a way that people would get a mental picture of. Oh, if I had a videotape of a session, right. Here's what it would look like. Because
yeah.
I remember somebody asked me, a psychiatrist actually asked me, what kind of music seems to work? Mm. You know. So, well, it's not really a treatment that, you know, someone lying there and you're playing a certain kind of song, and this is crap. This is not gonna help anybody.
Have you ever brought anyone back to life by playing "Man Who Would Be King"?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
But I can tell you some basic principles, and it shares some with art therapy too. Although it has a great departure from art therapy too. So, but I will give you a brief outline of the music therapy. Principles. It's a musical collaboration between a client and the therapist, whereby you're creating not necessarily a song, although I work a lot with songs because that came naturally to me, but the elements of music. So if you break music down into it, it's elements of melody, rhythm, harmony, tempo, including silence, and repetition, reflection, resolution, a million more words I could go on and on. But if you take all the elements that are in music, any one or any combination of them can be used collaboratively with a client. And it's partly in the doing of the musical exercise you engage in, and partly in the reflection on that exercise afterward, their reflection afterward, where the therapeutic benefit lies. So, for an example, I've written a lot of songs. I wrote my master's thesis on therapeutic songwriting. And the act of creating a song has a lot of therapeutic benefits in itself, because you're almost always working with someone who has not written a song before, doesn't consider themselves necessarily very musical, musically talented, although they're usually a music lover. Almost everyone is. And in the writing of the song, and in the recording of the song, and in the reflection back on what has happened, what is the singer saying, for example? Is that singer you? Or who is this person? Like, who knows them? Who would be surprised by what they just said in this song? And where do you think this song is going next? what's a logical song? Even if we just get a song title, let's make it easy. Let's not write the song yet. Let's write a bunch of titles of songs based on what we just looked at here. And that technique of stepping outside of yourself and having a look at yourself, which shares some elements of art therapy, I know, it shares with art therapy, can be really, really valuable for people. And I know that one of the things that drew me to songwriting with clients in music therapy was that I used to do that with my own songs over the years. I wouldn't necessarily do it regularly, but I would do it fairly often, though. I knew instinctively when I'd written a song which one was kind of, which one was more in the pop vein and which one was more in the personal vein. Mm-hmm. And all songwriters could easily draw the dividing line and put all their songs on one or the other side of that fence. And with the more personal tunes, it was easier to spend a bit more time and look at some of the complexities. Wow, what was going on with me? This is like 10 years ago. What was going on with me back then? Let's see now. Yeah, yes, this, this, and this. And it's in this song. And I'm writing about he, she, they, and I'm really writing about me. And what else is true about this song? Let's look at the way I put the rest of this song together. Yeah, that's true too. Yeah. Oh, that was a hard time, wasn't it? Yeah. Look at that. And this person I'd forgotten about, they show up in this tune too. You know, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit dream examination. It's a bit Jungian sometimes, if you want to get, and it can be, as you can get into it as deeply as you want. And it works not just with the more personal material, but with the pop material too. Like, what made me write? Like, why did I feel like writing this song that seems kind of slight lyrically? I wanted to get this musical message across instead, is often the answer. And what was so great about this musical message? Well, it means this, this, and this. And you can ask yourself the questions and answer them as well, or you can look at it with somebody else. I did it on my own for my own songs. But I think that's a really basic outline of some of the elements of, like, the therapy of songwriting, for example. And there's other principles that are at play when you talk about musical improvisation. Or music, or this instrument versus that instrument, or doing stuff with a group of people versus one-on-one. Mm. So, I mean, it's a pretty rich field. My one fear in starting the music therapy program way back, like 10 years ago, was that what if this turns out to be a really slight thing? Like, I wanted to do something that was serious.
Right.
Lots of fun, too, but serious. I wanted it to be therapeutically really useful. And I was hoping, oh, my God, what if it's hippies banging drums in the woods? Which has its own benefits too, but I didn't want it to be only that. and then I got into the field and I discovered there's a whole library of music therapy theory and practice, and my God, there's some people writing some pretty thick books out there about what they're doing, why they think it works, and what they think others are doing and why they think that works, and the theoretical discourse that goes on behind it. It's just astonishing. Wow, and I'm writing some stuff on my own for publication about music therapy because once you get into it, like you can really get into it far. Is this leading us into why I'm here today?
Well, it is.
Besides hanging out with Stu,
I was going to ask you what do you find more rewarding, knowing you help somebody overcome something and move their life a little bit forward, or having a guy in a bar come up to you and say, "Oh, you guys fucking rock, man."
Well. I don't miss that. Yeah. I mean, it was nice. It was nice enough, and I didn't take it for granted. But I find that I don't miss that at all. Although sober people are coming up and telling you, that was great. If I thought it had been great too, then we can have a little discussion. If I thought it was crap and they thought it was great, no matter, then I thought, well, maybe they're one of the people that thinks everything you do is great, you know. Yeah. And I can't spend much time with that. I'm sorry. I love the sentiment, but I can't go down that road. They're both pretty satisfying for different things. I mean, being in the music business, it's a pretty self-centered enterprise. You know, I mean, people here, I think it's the great trap of show business, really, in that people will respond to you as though you've done them a great favor. You've done them some therapeutic benefit, you know, and I know that you have. I'm not selling that short because I've listened to music all my life, too, and I know the benefit I got from it, too. But I also know after many years of living, not just being in the music business, but living, that musicians don't do it for your benefit. I mean, they really need to. People can have a really strong artistic need to get stuff out. But you know what? It is not going to kill you if you don't get it out. Mm. You can always write a song and play it for your friends, play it on a street corner. If you don't get to make a record and tour the world and have people slaver over you, it's not going to diminish your life. Other things will do that for you if you let them. But it's very essentially self-centered, and I did my best over the years to not let people put themselves down as they elevated me whenever we talked, and that only works so far. That works.
A similar thing happened to me once where, it was a real pivotal moment for me, and I got to thank, a musical moment I had during a concert, and I got to thank the person a couple of years later. Said, "Oh, this moment really meant a lot to me," and blah blah blah. And she said, "You know, thanks a lot, but whatever you went through there came from you. It had nothing to do with me."
Bless
whatever,
their heart.
Whatever happened because of you.
You want to? Who was that?
Odetta, actually.
Fantastic. That is exactly my sentiment. You know, you're doing it because you want to do it. If you're the performer, you want to do it. You're lucky to have an audience, if you have one. And if you don't have an audience, you're lucky to be able to do it still. And you should be very, very happy that you can do it. We should all be very lucky, those of us who have more developed musical ears than some. Although every music therapist knows, everybody's a musician. You know, and all the people who were told you can't sing back in school, whoever told you was wrong and either unwittingly or wittingly nasty by saying that. Because everybody's a musician, and we're not all Odetta, but we're all Odetta at heart. Yeah. You know, and that was a beautiful thing for her to say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too true. And many times I saw people say, "Oh man," and you could see they would give you all the money they had in the bank if you asked them.
Yeah.
and we weren't even big stars. The big stars live in a completely whacked world where people just will hurt themselves if you ask them to. You know, they will do the craziest things because your music has touched them in some way. Well, they have been touched by just the forces of the universe, which include them as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is not us. The people out there doing it, I don't mean to say that all musicians are doing it for selfish reasons. Some are, or it's for necessity too, some of them. But we are all in the professional music game are essentially involved in a self-centered enterprise that we're not doing for the audience. We have them in mind, certainly, and we don't wish them ill. It's not like that. But you have a need to... Whatever need you have is satisfied by this writing and performing and recording of your own material, and you're lucky to be able to do it. And if it touches people, by all means, let them know. You appreciate hearing that, but do your best to not let them put themselves down as they put you up at the top rung.
Yeah. Well, Thursday at noon, two worlds collide.
Yeah. I'm working as a music therapist in New Directions at the New Directions agency here in town, right across the street from us, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And my position there as clinician / head of music therapy services leads me to my appearance here today. Although I know you and I don't need an excuse to get together and talk music, and we'll do this again after today. But the reason I'm here today at this moment is because in 2 days. The new program that I'm the head of,
it's actually tomorrow.
Oh, pardon me, tomorrow, yes.
It's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday now, pardon me. Thank you, Stu. And you'll help me get home later, won't you?
Absolutely.
For the folks at home, Stu helped me Velcro my shoes earlier this afternoon, too, as well. Thursday, tomorrow at noon, at the top of the parking garage at New Directions, we're having a fundraising party for Project VIP, which I'm the head of. And Project VIP was put together in order to serve youth who are in danger of gang involvement, violence-prone activities, street involvement, and who are involved with the justice system. And when we started admitting clients into the program back in January when I started, I just moved back here in December, in January, we saw really quickly that almost half or more of the clients had fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, had a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, one of many. And we decided to provide special programming for them, which involves music therapy, creative arts therapy, as well as academic stuff and social skills and a supervised job placement eventually. So that program is just getting started now, and it's been running for a few months now, but it's really taking off soon. Because we're moving from a small space, a small office, about the size of our studio here, really, into a much bigger room where we're going to have more staff, more and more clients, and we have to structure the room in a very specific way for the fetal alcohol clients. After much research and consultation in town with people in the know, especially Dorothy Schwab, who's an occupational therapist who helped design the FAS classrooms at David Livingston School in the North End and Shaughnessy Park School. We know the colors the room should be, how big the room should be when we divide the room, and why material should be kept away from sight unless it's not being used, and the fact that we have to have a quiet room for timeouts. So the room needs renovations. This big space we have needs renovations. And the fundraising party tomorrow is specifically designed for that. Everyone in the healthcare business who might have an interest in FAS has been invited. Government people have been invited. Media people are invited. And the general public are also invited to attend. And it's free to attend. Lunch is for sale. And a number of items will be there for sale as well. There's a silent auction of many different things. And there will be
a Jeff Hatcher worship portion.
There'll be we're bringing Brother Don out of semi-retirement. Oh. I'm in retirement. Don still plays with the Hatcher Briggs Band. I'm bringing Don out of his basement to do some tunes with me. If I can catch Paul driving by nearby as well, I'll haul him to whack a tambourine. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there will be a few music therapists from the modest but talented local music therapy community. There's about 12 or 13 of us here in town. There's about 80 or something in BC, but there's about a dozen in all of Manitoba, and they're almost, except for one or two, they're all here in town. Anyway, we're going to have some fun there as well. I think I'm making some cookies for the event as well.
Ooh, cookies are good.
And it starts at noon, and the building is at 491 Portage. It's the Rice Financial Building, which is actually more of a landmark than its street address, 491.
Well, it's right above the bus depot.
The bus depot, yeah, right across the east street of that separates the bus depot from U of W,
yeah.
In fact. Yeah, the Rice Financial Building, which is quite a landmark at that intersection. Come in the front doors, go up to the sixth floor, ask them where the party is. Simple as that. Or you can go to the fourth floor where the party is. You can ask them where the party is, too. Our program is on 6, so if you go to 6 and say, where's the party, they're going to send you down to 4. You can just go to 4 and say, where's the party? They'll walk you out to the parking garage roof.
Neat.
Where we'll have the tent set up. So anybody who's in the neighborhood, just come by for 5, 10 minutes or to have lunch. We'll have a presentation. There we'll have one of my young clients will maybe making a speech there. I can't name him at the moment. But one of the young people I work with will be making a little speech. There'll be a couple other speeches, a presentation, and live music, and lunch. And it's supposed to be a sunny day.
Sounds like fun.
So if you're anywhere near there, from between 12 and about 1:30 or so, I'd say just pop upstairs. Wave at me and leave.
I'll do it. Well, it was a treat to have you in here, Jeff.
Thank you, Stuart. Always a pleasure. We haven't talked for quite a while except on the phone.
Yeah.
But in the context of music, maybe we should get together and just talk music again sometime.
We'll definitely. The door is always open here at the Twang Trust.
Lovely. Thank you.
So before we say official so long, will we see you again in a performing space ever?
I've been writing songs again in the last couple of years. Now that all my school writing is done, my master's thesis and all that, which completely drained any creativity I would ever have for the next couple of years. I've been writing songs again, and I do want to get down to recording them once I get a few things, other personal things out of the way. When the recordings happen, I don't really have an urge to perform them. I do have an urge to get them out to people, so they may be on the internet. I may just be sending them out to people who ask for them. Mm. I have to get a website designed soon.
And come on the radio, play them live.
Come out here and play them live, yeah. And I have a good feeling about giving music away. Mm. So I think that might be my approach.
Some older stuff may be doing that sort of thing too.
Well, actually, for the last 6 months, we've been working very hard. The brothers and Dave and myself, and along with our friend and musical friend, Hugh Swandell, we've been working together to catalog everything we've ever recorded, have it uploaded onto the internet, and then get the new recording gear, which the guys have now, in order to record the new material that they are writing and that I'm also writing. So all that stuff will be available at some point, including some tarted up versions of some fused material. Once the big stuff gets out of the way, we might have some fun with going into the writing on the wall, sad eyes thing, and remixing and tarting that up for...
Keen.
That would be fun. It would be fun for us.
Yeah.
The Miami horns, and we'll bring them all in. Anyway, so that stuff, some of it is available now, apparently. I mean, Hugh has got the Fuse, the 6th. I think it might be under Hatcher Briggs, actually.
Right. HatcherBriggs.com, you can go and buy that thing.
HatcherBriggs.com, there's stuff for sale there now. And iTunes has some stuff available as well. And it'll be available at other sites, too. But that's been a big project over the last 6 months, getting this mountain of material from the past finally committed digitally and then uploaded. Stuff that was done, of course, before computers were thought of, even.
Mm-hmm.
And then bring it up to date as quickly as possible so that we can get new stuff up there as well.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, we'll have you back here to tell us when it happens.
Well, you and I will be in touch, yeah, and we'll put a good date together, and we'll talk about something or other.
Sounds like a plan. Well, here you are. We're going to go out with you and Billy once again. This is from the very last time that the Blue Shadows ever played Winnipeg. It was at the Palomino Club, March of 1994. And it's an old Smokey Robinson song that you'll probably remember. Here comes, kids. We'll see you in the next half of the show with Rami Mays and Gurf Morlix.
August 11th to 13th, Victoria Park comes alive at the sound of the Regina Folk Festival. With performances by Ani DeFranco, Steve Earle, Feist, Bedouin Sound Clash, Utah Phillips, and many more.
I'm on the rocky road, heading down off the mountain.
www.reginafolkfestival.com.
And as my steps echo, echo, louder than before.
CKUW is proudly supported by the King's Head Pub, 120 King Street. Now featuring nightly specials on some of your favorite brands from 7 p.m. to midnight, Monday through Thursday. Call 956-KING for complete info. Fridays and Saturdays always feature live music at the King's Head, and Sunday's always industry night with happy hour all night long and free pool. The King's Head is a private club. Members and guests welcome. Membership's just $5, available anytime at the door. That's the King's Head, 120 King Street, a proud partner with CKUW 95.9 FM.
GarageLand is brought to you in part by the Fort Garry Brewing Company, Manitoba's own since 1930. Now available in cans, just in time for the summer.
Wilco's back.
Last cigarettes, all you can get.
Saturday, July 1st at Burton Cummings Theater. Don't miss Wilco. Get tickets now at all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge by phone 204-780-3333 or online at Ticketmaster.ca or HOB.ca. Check out Wilco's latest, Kicking Television, live in Chicago, in stores now. For more info, visit WilcoWorld.net. Produced by House of Blues Concerts Canada.
The Winnipeg Free Press, your garage sale guide, is a proud supporter of CKUW Radio. Grab the free press every Saturday for comprehensive garage sale listings.